Welcome to Creative Piecemeal Podcast, a podcast for creatives. I'm your host, Tami Takeishi. Join me for compelling conversations with artists, actors, authors, musicians, and other creatives about the impact of the creative and fine arts in their lives and our ever-changing world. Thank you for listening. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Creative Piecemeal Podcast. I'm really excited to have another fellow music therapist on the show today. I'm joined by John Head. He is a music therapist with Houston Methodist Behavioral Health, and he's also active in research and providing presentations in the metro area and beyond. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you are part of a really huge and wonderful Houston Methodist team. What led you to decide to become a music therapist and especially the medical setting?
These are the types of things that just kind of happen. You know, it's like if you point your boat a certain direction, things like that happen. So I was in the Navy for 5 years as a percussionist. I feel like I have to keep going back. Like the moment I say one thing I did, I have to go back like five more years and say what I was doing before that for it to make sense. But so I was in the Navy band for 5 years at Navy Band Northwest. And I think I had kind of an attitude of like, you have to looking back on it, I can't tell if it was just my attitude or what maybe the jazz program at Texas State, which I really loved, they put this idea in my head. But sometimes musicians get an idea where like you have to get a job where all you do is play music. Otherwise, you've somehow failed life or as a musician, or you didn't really become a musician. Like you weren't successful in that. So I guess I believed that to some extent. And I was like, I couldn't wait any longer to finish my degree. I was like, I'm just going to audition for the Navy band and see what happens and go from there. And I was like, yeah, great. An opportunity to like play. So I went and did that. It was really hard for me at first. Later on, I got in the swing of it. But then I just kind of realized, it's like, I don't think I like performing as much as I thought I would. And I think it's the type of performing it was. But then I was kind of like, you know, the thing that's missing is feeling like I'm making kind of a direct impact of some sort. I think the impact of the Navy band is kind of playing music for someone isn't the same thing as like dragging someone out of a burning building. I guess that's maybe the best way I could describe that is like, I wanted to do something that was a little bit more hands-on, a little more direct. And I was reading a lot about music in the brain and stuff like that. I was a big fan of Radiolab. And so very enthusiastically was just like checking all that stuff out. And then my mom met someone that was a music therapist in New Orleans by accident. And they're like, that person said, oh, I went to Colorado State. It's the best one to go to. So it's like, okay. And plus I had the GI Bill to go anywhere. And I was like, well, why not Colorado State? So I did that. And then I did my internship at Institute for Therapy Through the Arts, which is a great place to do an internship. That's in Chicago. And then so my first gig was working inpatient psych in Olympia, Washington. And then I was like, I think I need a little bit more skills. I think I need to get better at this. So I decided to come back, did my master's at Sam Houston State. So this is where the whole point of telling you this is to answer your question is like, I wasn't looking to work at a hospital necessarily. I was kind of frustrated with the fact I hadn't really used the NMT stuff that I really wanted to use. And that's where I thought I was really going to land. And so I did my graduate practicum at Houston Methodist. And the gig was basically to follow Jen around, Jennifer Townsend, who's like an amazing music therapist, but just like a really great person and a really great boss. And there was a PRN music therapy position, like 10 hours a week. I was like, fine, I will apply for that. And then I was like, I kind of don't want to be known as like the mental health music therapist. I want to try these other things. But, you know, when I was in my internship, I was like, I kind of like mental health. I think I'm good at it. And then working in the inpatient unit I was in Olympia was kind of like drinking through a fire hose. It was just like, this is too many people like coming in and out. It was kind of sad. Like I couldn't really handle it as much. But doing music therapy the way I got to eventually really do it at Houston Methodist was like, they came to my office where I had a music therapy office, you know, like it didn't start out that way, but eventually got that way. And it's like, they come to me, we do therapy, and then they go. It brought so much more peace to my life than doing the kind of music therapy where you're driving around everywhere, or the kind of music therapy where you're running around all over the hospital. I did a little bit of that during the pandemic. And I also worked in outpatient infusion in the cancer area too, which I liked. And I really liked that population and everything. And I found myself really liking mental health. And then I found myself really like kind of digging into like, well, there's like a lot missing. I felt like in music therapy and in mental health, which is weird because the psychology has been around for forever. And there's so many different ways of non-music therapy, mental health, psychology. There's so many ways of doing that. And I sometimes feel like as music therapists, we're kind of trying very hard to be original and like prove what makes us worthy. I feel like the baseline life of a music therapist is somewhat defensive and like self, like I'm important, you know, I am. And trying to prove that because no one gets it. And every time someone does guess, they're always wrong. And it's usually something that's kind of demeaning, you know, it's like, oh, so you go play music and they get healed. And I'm always like, no. And that's when I was like, oh, that's what a microaggression is, you know, that kind of thing. And so I eventually got to really enjoy, very lucky to do it the way I do it now. And it took time, but that's how I got there. So I didn't like come back to Houston with like, I'm going to go to Houston, work at Houston Methodist. You know, it was not it. It was just like, it kind of fell in. I got very lucky.
And it's such a diverse program. You know, they offer music therapy to so many different populations within the hospital. And of course, within the whole scope of music therapy as a whole, it's just one slice of the pie of what we are able to do and offer to various communities. And it's really interesting because we all take this skill set and then we hone it and we craft it and polish it in a certain way to meet the needs of the patients, clients, students, what have you.
Yeah. And it's funny. I think when you're younger, I think younger therapists tend to think about things like, okay, what do I do? Like, tell me what to do and I'll do it. And then that'll make me a better therapist, right? And my patients will get better. Also, we don't have a whole lot of power over our patients getting better. I think we all want to believe that like we are in the job of doing music to people and then they get better. And actually, that's what a lot of people think what we do is. And as you get, I think, more mature in your practice and as a therapist, it's like what you do is important, but also how you are is more important. Am I constantly doing a decision tree in my head of like, okay, so they said this, now I need to do this. And they said this, now I need to do this. Or is it more like, okay, they're freaked out and I'm going to try not to freak them out anymore. You know, and like try to be, help them kind of co-regulate whatever that looks like, you know? And so I think it's tempting to kind of be like, I need to collect a ton of skills. I need to get a lot of letters after my name. I've got to do that, which I do that too. But it's because it's like interesting. It's like, how do you come at it from that perspective? You know, and I think it's almost impossible not to be an integrative therapist. I think to say you only do one type of therapy is to say you only see one type of person, and we don't see one type of person ever. So like I could take a more CBT approach and be like, okay, what thought are you having at this present moment, you know, and working through what to do with it. But I also can't help but do a psychodynamic approach to that too and be like, well, where did that thought come from? And why is that important? Does that normalize your automatic thought? You know, like these are like things that like, why would I just use a hammer all the time? Why don't I also use a screwdriver? I'd just be banging screws into the wall and be like, yeah, it kind of works, you know? So just, yeah. So that's my thought on your thought.
Yeah. And I love that. I really love that we can hold space for people and that we can bring in all those different things that you talked about in sessions, depending on what people need. And I think that's almost a misconception of our field that people who are not practicing music therapists, you know, they don't know from the outside looking in that we're almost like chameleons in a way, bringing in all these different skill sets, like you were mentioning CBT and psychoanalytic and things like that. If you've been feeling burned out, stressed, overwhelmed, or exhausted, the resources and courses at the Self-Care Institute are here to support you. The Self-Care Institute was founded by Dr. Ami Kunimura and provides support for individuals and organizations with burnout prevention, burnout recovery, and stress management. I've personally taken a few of these courses and found them to be super helpful, both professionally and personally. The care you give yourself matters just as much as the care you give to others. But if self-care is difficult for you, you're not alone. And the Self-Care Institute is here to support your well-being, resilience, and sense of fulfillment at work and at home. For more information, visit selfcareinstitute.com or go to the show notes and click on the link.
Yeah, it's like, I think we're always trying to, again, like it can be kind of exhausting to always be kind of educating people and trying to receive validation and on what you do and that it's real and that it's important. And actually what the other person's picture of what that is just not accurate. There are times where I'm like, I get so exhausted by that. And it's another reason why I'm kind of happy I'm in an office, because I don't have to be like running up down the elevators, having someone see my name tag. I mean, like, I'm happy to like educate people and all that stuff. But at the same time, it gets old. And I think then people get like guilty. They feel guilty. It's like, oh, I shouldn't feel whatever feeling that I'm feeling about that. I shouldn't feel kind of put upon. But justifying your existence and your value all the time is exhausting. And I think a lot of our patients experience that, right? People who have experienced trauma are sitting there going like, I have to constantly seek validation. You know, I have to constantly prove that what happened to me was real or whatever. And like, I'm not making a one-to-one comparison, but just the experience of having to constantly justify yourself is really hard. And I think, you know, your podcast is about creative people doing creative things. I mean, all creative people are sitting here like trying to figure out how to make it, or trying to sit here and figure out like how to explain to somebody that I'm an artist, and what glib like response am I going to get for saying out loud I'm an artist, and then have to explain and then justify your existence. I think it's one of those things where it's like a dreaded barbershop moment for me. Like, what do you do for a living? I'm like, I don't, I'm not talking about, I'm just like, I'm a therapist. I just leave it at that. They have a picture in their mind of that, which is a little bit more accurate. And so I just like leave it there. But that doesn't mean I don't advocate for music therapy. I went to the Texas legislature to try to get a bill passed. And I like went, like spoke to the committee, which was really weird. It's a very strange thing, because I'm like, do I call you Your Honor? I don't know. Like, all these like dumb things were coming to my head. Like, I was like, Your Majesty, I'm here to give this, have you please sign this bill? You know, I was like, just call them representative or whatever. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Advocacy burnout is such a real thing in our field. I'm on the task force, and it's just amazing how much work goes into validating our field. And when I worked in other places, I definitely felt that scrutiny that you were talking about, where people are like, oh, who are you? What do you do? Or people thinking you're like an entertainer. Thankfully, in my current position, I don't get that.
Yeah, they get it.
Yeah.
It takes so much time to build that, right? And if you, I think that's what makes it hard too. Like, and that's one of the things I like about Houston Methodist, is that in general, the rule of thumb anyway, is to put a music therapist in one unit and get them settled there. And they become a part of the team of that unit. So they have more ownership, and then they see the same people every day, not different people. You don't want to be, you know, this is kind of a hint for all of our music therapists out there that want to start a program somewhere. Don't be the music therapist for the entire institution. Be the music therapist for like hallway 1B, where these type of patients are, and get your allocation for that. Because it's like, I've been working with the same people in behavioral health for 5 years. Those psychologists know how to refer to me. They listen to me when I notice things about patients. I was able to give two different kind of in-house kind of talks about what is music therapy, who music therapists are, and stuff like that. And I don't really get that questioning from them, which is cool. So, you know, every once in a while, it's like, I don't really do that, or, you know, whatever. having that frees up so much real estate in your mind to be creative. If you're not sitting there kind of doing the, like, why doesn't anybody understand me? Why don't I always explain myself type thing? Then it kind of frees up your mind to, like, get excited to take ownership of what you do, and less of the, what is the point of this? No one understands me. I'll just go eat worms. whatever that childhood thing is, or that nursery rhyme.
But, yeah. We've obviously touched on some misconceptions about music therapy, but what are some things that you think people are getting right about music therapy, especially now that there's stuff more in the media? And for example, your recent article in the Houston Chronicle, where you were talking about the connections of music therapy and Stranger Things.
So one thing that they're getting right, when that first article came out, I was like, wow, it actually talks about the profession. That was the thing that was like, oh my gosh, someone made that delineation. It started off with the people in HR reaching out to me. The PR people came and saw me, and they're like, hey, there's this article that has energy. Maybe that will help us get this thing done. I said, sure. But that was one of the things where I was like, okay, I'm going to make it clear. Music therapy is not an intervention. It's a profession. So that's one of the things. And so one of the things people are getting right, that was really cool to see that. They're like, okay, well, here's the history of this profession. I'm like, wow, someone said that we exist. And then the next part of that is, okay, well, I didn't really realize even for myself that's what's missing. So when they came to talk to me, I was like, it's really important to me that you do not talk about music therapy as an intervention. Music therapy is a profession, and music therapists do music therapy, full stop. Like, that is the most, if there's one thing I hope that you communicate, is that music therapy is a profession where music therapists do it. Because they'll get other stuff wrong. Like, they'll say something about magic or power, or, you know, put in whatever adjective that you think of there that's just kind of, I don't know, silly. It's like, oh, it's magical and it's powerful. And it's, I'm like, that sells a lot of newspapers. And the other thing is that people use the same stuff all the time in the news. They'll say things, everything we thought we knew was wrong about whatever. And that's never true. It's always like, no, they just added new information. It doesn't change. And they even use that in, like, movies and stuff. Forget what you think you knew that you thought, but what you thought is not right anymore. You know, forget everything you thought you knew about Star Wars. It's all changed. Just everything's changed. And it's like, it hasn't really changed. So it's like, no, we haven't. No, the whole world isn't turned upside down about bread. There's a lot of things about bread that we know that is still bread. Forget what you thought you knew about turnips, you know, or whatever. It's not like that. So we're just adding to what we already know. So no, music is not magic. It's very old. It's been doing it for a long time. Forget everything you thought about music. You wouldn't believe the things it does to your brain. We had no idea. It's like, no, we've known for a long time. This profession has been around for a long time. Iterations of this profession or that idea has been around for a long time. So I think that's really important to me, to say, like, hey, music therapists do music therapy. And when you talk about it that way, when you go to talk to state representatives, you can talk about the music therapist doing music therapy. And that was one of the things I tried to do when I was doing that. It was like, there's someone here. They see these patients. These are the types of work things they do. Someone here, they see these patients. This is the type of stuff they do. Do you really want someone who's not licensed working with these really vulnerable populations, talking about the magic and power of music? I don't want that, you know, for, like, my fictional children and my late grandparents, you know, whatever. I don't want that for anybody that receives music therapy or from somebody that says they have it or do it or whatever. So, but we have a complicated profession, you know.
We do. We do. I love it, though. And it's really interesting how you mentioned that, you know, newspapers will just talk about, like, the magic and the healing power of music, because Andrew Rossetti, another music therapist in our profession, he said it bothered him when the New York Times interviewed him, and the title, because he said he couldn't pick the title was The Healing Power of Music. And he's like, and same thing as what you were mentioning, like, those kinds of titles grab people's attention. And then, you know, you have to go in and, like, educate people.
Yeah. I think we'd be a little more assertive too, and be like, please don't do that.
Yeah.
And give them a serious look do not be accommodating. She's like, no, please don't call my profession that. Thank you. And just be real with people there. It's like, oh my God, please don't, talk about people about how magically healing I am. I have not healed a damn person. Like, yes. I mean, in a metaphorical, we're talking like, in what I do, I talk about, you know, the brain is very important, and our training, and a lot of the training I received is brain-based kind of stuff, which is really great. But one thing we can also talk about is our minds, like our minds, which arise from our brain as this other thing. And our brains change with when you have different experiences, right? So sometimes when I talk about, like, to my patients, my clients at Houston Methodist, we call them patients, you know, I talk about, like, hey, you know, you're learning in your therapy that, you know, maybe you're stuck on some certain thoughts. Maybe we can use the music space as a way to explore different ways of change of being. Maybe you try out that new thing that they're saying, but how do we do that musically? And I kind of have to come up with that, you know, like, how do we work on communication? How do we, I don't know, like, it seems like you have a hard time. You got a lot of shoulds. So let's sit and improvise. What shoulds came up while you were improvising? I think there's somebody, I think it was the person who did, was it reality focused therapy that talks about, like, shoulding yourself or shoulding your pants or whatever he calls it. You know, it's just like, you should. Oh, I sounded awful. I was like, well, you sound really upset about that. What was your expectation? Like, I don't know. I'm like, well, when was the last time you played piano? Never. I'm like, okay. So why should you play piano to the level of who? Like, what are we comparing yourself to? And kind of like some Socratic questionings and genuine curiosity and kind of moving through that. I'm like, I wonder what it would be like if instead of right and wrong, we talked about, like, you, what you intended to do and what you didn't intend to do, and kind of see it that way. And then give them the experience of thinking about that while doing something that gives automatic feedback. There's like a feedback loop with playing music, right? And so you get to, oh, I guess I'll try out this new way of thinking or this. And so I'm being very kind of cognitive, but it's very kind of easier to explain that way. And you get to experience what it's like, because you and I are musicians, right? So we've experienced being really angry and like just wanting to throw the guitar or the violin or kick a hole through the bass drum, whatever it is, the things we wanted to do. And also living in the world of, we're like, in America, like, music is a sport. I hate singing shows, but I think it's just because I hate reality shows. But like, singing shows to me, it's like, man, that person was so good, and they were just like kicked off on a national stage, and it's like, it's a sport. It's this high stakes sport. And then you have people that are judging them that don't know anything about singing, you know, I mean, a lot of that, like, and it's like, what is this? So as a creative person too, there's like, in America, we're very individualistic and like competitive and all this stuff. And it's like absolutely nothing to do with the creation of art. It's like the only thing that we can think of. Like, I know, let's have a competition. It's like with other shows, they're like, okay, it's the devil and someone else, and they solve crimes. You know, it's like everybody's like, it's so-and-so and so-and-so, and they solve crimes. And that's like the only thing that we can come up with is like, okay, it's either a competition or they solve crimes. One of the two types of TV you can make. But yeah, so like, I try to, like, I've got someone in front of me who's completely naive to what it might be to make music, and try to give them a lot of the stuff I never had in terms of that, in this low stakes environment of like, hey, is there something wrong with me going, boop? No. Okay. What about this note? Boop. No. Okay. What about this one? Boop. I'm like, okay. So how do you know when a note is wrong? You get this jumpy feeling, and before you know it, your hands are off the keyboard. And so you can't even see like what mistake you made. Like, you can't even see it. You're not even allowing to give yourself the information. Some sort of emotion just happened there. Wow, what is that emotion? There's something you don't know about. It's like shame. Okay, maybe shame, guilt, sadness, anger. What's going on? And then working through that. And who put that thought there in your life, you know, that you should be perfect after watching me do something once and trying to reproduce it? Are there other things like that in your life where, like, you should be perfect this somehow. One thing I'm really interested in is how our perception changes, our perception of time changes when we do things slowly, and also like our perception of effort and stuff like that. I've a lot of times I'll set a timer with a metronome to have someone practice something that they wanted to learn or something. And I'll set it for like 2 minutes and it'll be slow. And my metronome is over by me. I'm the only one that can see it. And it's set to go off at two, like just turn itself off at 2 minutes. And I ask people, I'm like, how long do you think you were practicing for? And they're like, oh, probably like 10 minutes. 6, 7 minutes, I don't know. I'm like, you practice that for 2 minutes. So there's something about doing something slowly and methodically that might make us feel like we're wasting time. So I always talk about the importance of slowing down, especially when you're doing something creative. Like I had a patient who was telling me about this big problem and she didn't know what solution to give to her husband or whatever. And I was like, okay, well, maybe you just tell him what the problem is. And like, maybe you don't need to know the solution. Like maybe he cannot also not know with you at the same time. You can work it out together. So there's that not knowing, slow down, turn the temperature down. That's kind of like the approach I try to take in therapy too. Is I don't care if you ever learned how to play piano. I don't care if you ever finish this song. It's about what was it like to do that? That's all it's all about. It's nice to have a finished song. It really is. And it's great. But sometimes they're like so enamored with the process themselves that they were like talking about, like, yeah, it's like that time I play guitar with you. And then like, I played the same thing fast 5 times. I didn't get anywhere. And it's like, yeah. So you have to slow down sometimes. What's the emotion behind playing the same thing 5 times and playing the thing you don't intend 5 times and then just going, ah. It's like, I know you can play that perfectly slowly. And there's brain stuff going on in that, right? I'm building the wrong motor plan, and I'm getting more reps in on the incorrect motor plan. I'm having a physiological, emotional reaction to building the incorrect motor plan, and I'm getting worse at it. Why not slow down and do the thing that you intend to do instead of just bang your head against the wall? But that skill of stopping and slowing down is really important in mental health.
Definitely. I mean, whether it applies to directly to patients or even us as musicians and music therapists, you know, slowing down, taking the time to learn things for our patients, or even just learning things for ourselves, you know, and exploring our own personal music journeys, you know, slowing down is always, it's always something that it's like, oh, okay, fine, I have to do that.
Yeah. And there's a flip side to that too, which is that in like feminist psychotherapy counseling kind of approach, you would think too, it's not just what can you do differently and stuff. It's also consider the environment you're in. What is the impact that has on you? So it can actually be very, very condescending to tell somebody to take a deep breath, to slow down, because maybe it has nothing to do with them. Maybe they aren't doing anything wrong, you know? Maybe it's like, mm-hmm. maybe the world's kind of messed up and there's nothing wrong with them.
Yeah. Very good point.
So the other thing is like, I know that when I'm angry, if a person came up to me and said, okay, now take a deep breath. If that, I would be like, you go to hell. You know what I mean? So I, you know, we talk about the ISO principle a lot. I'm not going to sit there and not mirror that. It's going to be completely invalidating. And also, if an institution is running somebody ragged, if a hospital, because of the pandemic, for instance, our nurses are just totally run ragged because they've been working ridiculously hard. We've lost a bunch of them, you know, that's to be expected. I think it's pretty nationally accepted as a reality for nursing. It can be condescending to be like, here is a subscription to a meditation app. It makes sense. It's a great resource, but you know, if there's some things which are really helpful in a more acute situation, but in a systemic situation, it's, yeah. So that's one thing with that is like, sometimes with my patients, I'm like, okay, well, is the situation you're in the problem? I mean, if someone was like homeless, I'm not going to do like cognitive behavioral therapy to fix their cognitions that are just negative. You know, like, yeah. Well, yeah, you don't have food. Like, of course, You don't have time to yourself, whatever it is. I can't fix that problem. I don't try to, you know, I don't try to fix it with mindfulness. Our hospital, along with those initial kind of like, okay, wellness type things that we're offering our employees, which in a kind of an acute state, it's very helpful. In a kind of a chronic state, which we've been in for a couple of years, you run the risk of sounding condescending and actually being condescending, and maybe a little tone deaf, which is why I'm really glad that Houston Methodist started their emotional health and well-being clinic, which only serves our employees. So I get to see our employee patients. And one of my favorite things about my job is to work with them, because it's like, you can see what it's like to be in different places. And sometimes it's very much like maybe a family history thing, maybe in a more of like an adjustment disorder thing. Sometimes we see people with severe persistent mental illness like that's maybe never been identified before with them. And sometimes it might be institutional. It might be like just maybe they're in the wrong place, you know, or might be like the wrong job for them. Maybe they're like, man, I do not want to be a nurse. I really wanted to be a microbiologist, or I want to be a whale trainer, whatever thing it is. And then it's like, hey, well, there's nothing wrong with you. This is what it's like to be you and be in a place that maybe isn't right for you, which is also really helpful for people. You know, the burden of mental health that we have in this country and the stigma we have around it is like, so go fix yourself and come back, you know? And it's like, shit, if I can say that, that's tough. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go fix yourself is like the American way, you know, in a lot of ways. Go fix yourself, come back when you're fixed. So, and also when like money's involved and you've got to pay for mental health issues, you might feel guilty that you're spending all this money and you're not getting any better. You know, I was doing air quotes just then. You're not getting any better. And so think about that. Or someone else is paying for your care. And think of the autonomy it gives you to receive care without a fee, to get better. Because there's a feedback loop of guilt and shame that comes with the money. And people in this country don't like to ask for help. And now when you ask for help, not only that, but you're paying for it. So, oh my God, I'm not getting better. It's my fault. People don't feel like that was a broken leg. So that's another right, you know, as it stands now, emotional health and well-being is for, there's no charge for our employees.
That's really great that your company offers that. And I really hope it's something that will blossom maybe in other companies across the world. That would be really, I mean, maybe it exists. I don't know, but I feel like it should be more widespread.
It exists in other countries.
Ah, there's the rub. We're going to switch gears a little bit. Sure. I love that you gave such an in-depth inside look about music therapy, because we don't always get a chance to talk about that as in-depth on this show. And so it's really great to dig in and let the audience know a little bit more about that. But now we get to know a little bit more about you. I was wondering, what is a piece of advice that you ignore and one that you always follow?
Oh, man. It's funny. Okay. My dad doesn't listen to this podcast, so I'm just going to say. So what I think the best piece of advice I've learned is to ask yourself, how much do you actually believe that? I think that is a really good question to always be asking yourself, and be aware of like black and white declarations. Don't forget everything you think you know. That's maybe a good one. But okay, so like I remember my dad once, he told me, he's like, son, don't ever get married unless you have $10,000 in the bank. And for a while there, that was actually like something that stressed me out to think about. I'm like, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I don't have $10,000. I don't have $10,000. It's like a weird thing that like stuck in my head. And then I was like, so happy to let that go and be like, these little rules we create for ourselves that are just kind of like based in nothing, like things we heard someone say once. Like this thing, something I heard someone say once, like stuck in my head. Then the better advice is kind of ask yourself, how much do you actually believe that? And then let yourself let go of like kind of these silly things. That my dad has given me a lot of other great advice. But that was not one, because it just stressed me out. It was a should. Don't do a should.
There you go. So getting back to the creative process, which it sounds like you have a lot to talk about on that. So I'm curious, what is your favorite part and least favorite part of the creative process?
I love those moments where you get lost in what you're doing. And I hate those moments where you get scared to go start doing the thing you love getting lost doing. There's always times where, like, I'll be working on a song with a patient, and then I'm like, okay, I need to go back and finish that. Like, and I'll get into GarageBand and I'll like flesh something out. I'm like, oh, this sounds really cool. Oh, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's just like this happy little thing. You lose track of time, and you're like, oh, this is so fun. I'm gonna sing one more track on top of this. How many harmonies can we fit? Maybe we do one track for the right side, one track for the left side, and one track for the center. So that's three vocal tracks on just that one part. And I'm gonna do another one of those. And you're just like, wow, this is really fun creating, just seeing it. And then there's that other part where you're like, I'll put that off. I hate that. I wish I had just do it tattooed on my forehead for that kind of stuff, because it's so fun once you get into it.
It really is. Yeah. I asked that question once to someone and they said, done. My favorite part is done.
Man, yeah, that's pretty fun too. It's kind of like, it's tough to like, I think with music too. I don't know if it's this way for like maybe drawing or dancing or other things, or poetry even. The practice part can get to feel really exercisey, and that's also can be really kind of stimulating too. Like, I'm going to see if I can play this pattern at 80 BPM, at 90 BPM. You're just playing the same thing, and you're like doing it, and it's very exercisey, and it's like reps versus the creative part, which is like, well, what do I do with this? You know, you think like poetry people are just sitting there practicing spelling words. Like, no, they're like writing, they're putting stuff together. There's a technical aspect of they're like creating, and it's like, I think I don't miss performing as much, but I do miss like creating my own stuff. So I think the pandemic kind of took that out of my sails a little bit. I'm always kind of like dipping my toe back into that. You know, go play a jam session every once in a while. You know, or I actually went up and did like a theater thing. I'd never done a theater thing before. I did that like on Tuesday,
Oh, cool.
which was fun. It was like total different muscle. Did like a reading. There's like a cool thing here that's called Grown Up Story Time. That's what it is. Gust.
You talked a little bit about how you like to stretch your creative muscles. If you could sort of play any other instrument or do any other thing, unlimited time to do that, what would you do?
Okay. So I like rhythm section instruments. I think I would stick with that. I think it would be really cool to be good at bass really well. And like my favorite type of piano was like New Orleans stride piano. Was like the coolest thing ever. I love that stuff. So I would love to be good at that and just bass in general, because bass is so much fun. It is so great. People don't realize like drums, it's like once you play drums, you can play the same thing for all, like a million different songs, and you're fine. Like the same set of coordination, hand and foot, hand and hand, hand and foot, hand and hand. Like that coordination, just that little formula of coordination there. Speed it up, slow it down, and you can play like half a pop music. But like bass is like a really fun, active thing, and there's all these like little things you can do to like, I don't know. My brother got me a little 3/4 size bass, and I love noodling on it every so often.
Nice. So you're gonna do that a little bit more?
I hope so. I mean, it's so funny. I'm always like, I want to be such a better musician than I am, but I just have like not had the time to take a damn lesson. I would love it, but pandemic. I have to keep reminding myself that the pandemic happened and is still kind of happening. It's different now, but like, it's like I have to keep reminding myself. It's like, oh, that's why I didn't take any bass lessons. What else was I trying to do? I was trying to finish my master's degree. I was trying to do stuff. And I'm on my second master's right now. And I'm just like, I have to remind myself that like, I don't do some of that stuff because I'm doing other things that are really fun too, you know? But I do, but it is like, it's like an itch. I'm like, oh, I want to go back and like do that for me a little bit.
Well, congratulations on your second master's. Are you
There's
done
no,
with it or are you still working on
no. No, there's no second. There's no congratulations yet. I'm working on
Early congratulations.
it. Good for you for trying, John. That's what you could say.
You go. Yeah, I also have two master's degrees. My parents are like, "Are you sure you want to do that?"
What's your other one in?
Music ed.
Music ed. Okay, cool. I'm doing counseling. You know, it just depends on which way you want to point your boat.
Nice. Yeah, I did music ed first and then music therapy.
Okay. Cool. That's awesome.
Okay, we're going to completely flip the script here. What top three meals would you recommend to tourists visiting your part of the world?
Okay, so people don't realize that Houston is like the most diverse city in the country. So I'm going to throw that out there. People don't realize that we have really good Vietnamese food. We have really good actual Mexican food, not just Tex-Mex. And man, there was a place down the street called Prego. Oh God, did I get that right? No, it wasn't Prego. Sorry with an F. Anyway, but it's not here anymore, so I'm not going to piss off anybody. It was amazing. It was amazing. I used to go there all the time. Oh my God. And I would eat something and I'd get another one. And it was all handmade pasta there. It was surreal. And then I would recommend also going to Urbe, which is also run by Chef Hugo that runs Hugo's. It's more kind of like more down home cooking Mexican food. Hugo's is like very rich abuelita type, Distrito Federal like Mexican food, which you should go do. The best banh mi is actually in Kingwood. So if you want to get a really good banh mi, go to Vianwich in Kingwood. That place is ridiculous. It's the only place, like when I go to Kingwood, I'm like, I have to go there. So I think it's like if you go live somewhere else for a while and then you move back to a city, you really know what you miss. Like it's really stupid. I miss Taco Cabana breakfast tacos just because when I lived in Washington, like no, there's no drive-through decent breakfast taco that has like fresh tortillas. It's that cold, like cardboardy with like iceberg lettuce. You really can get me talking about like trying to get a good taco outside of Texas. It's a nightmare.
We could have a whole podcast episode on tacos.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes. That's food is, I just love that creative aspect with food as well, you know?
Oh yeah, I like to do as much as I can with as little as possible. A lot of my friends will be like, "Oh, we got this super duper smoker and it takes 9 hours and we're gonna like sous vide it and then we're gonna da 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 da." I'm like, "Oh my God, what can you do with a pan though? If you have a pan, what can you do with a pan?" I love that. I think that's also like, reflective of like my times being dirt broke as hell. The brokest I'd ever been, it was living in Chicago and I was living off of my GI Bill. And it was, I had pasta. I had like some pasta at my house. So I like went down to the 7-Eleven that was at the corner and I went to the free garnishes for the hot dogs. And I got the diced tomatoes and I got the onions and the garlic. And then I bought like a thing of like canned spam or something and like went back up and took, I got butter and parmesan. I made like a base like sauce and everything and like made food for like no money. But I think being broke like that, you kind of learn to like open your pantry and go, I bet I could make something with this. And
Yeah.
like I've got two eggs and I've got some pasta. I think I can do something.
And it also brings more on a more serious side, it brings such a humility to what you do in your work because you know you've probably been in a variety of life situations and then you're coming and you're helping people in a therapeutic setting and like there's no judgment, you know, it's a safe zone and you know you're able to connect with people through music and you may obviously you're not wanting to do transference or counter transference, but I'm sure you can, you know, just
You can't help but
being,
do that.
yeah, you can't help it, you know.
It's not transference and counter transfer is not a choice. It's
Right.
like that just happens. There are people that I work with where I go, I can't do this. There's something about this person. It's hitting a wrong note in my head. At those moments, it's really important to like reach out, do some supervision and stuff. We're not all Carl Rogers. Like I can't. I would love to feel unconditional positive regard for everybody. I don't though. And I'm not going to feel guilty about that. Like the shoulds with that, it's like, no, I will try because it's like, oh, there's something I had to learn about myself there. That's really important. But you have to be creative. Like you have to like, all right, I've got an iPad and, I only have the Beat app. What am I going to do with this person? This person likes really heavy metal. I can't play that stuff, but I can get some of the stuff on the keyboard and I can plug it MIDI into the iPad and I can make some riffy kind of stuff with that. I can make it sound like an electric guitar. I can do stuff. But that's the thing. People don't like the music therapy is a profession, not an intervention. Only that professional can do that. that has those musical skills and those therapeutic skills and can do that. So when people like use apps and stuff, like, you know, we already created the technology that helps us understand our own minds and the minds of other people. And it's called music. I don't really need to put the headphones on with a thing that's going to do something to me. I can actually do something a little more interactive that will change my mind because I'm actually changing my behavior, you know?
What is something that you learned in the past few years that you've applied to either your work as a music therapist or just your life as a musician?
I'm always learning new stuff on GarageBand. I think it's probably the most helpful thing that I keep learning about in music. And I think the things that have helped me the most in music therapy is learning things that aren't music therapy based. Like there's so much that's missing. I just finished writing a manuscript about mentalizing based therapy, which we don't teach much in the US. We actually don't teach it in the US. And there's a lot about mentalizing based therapy in art therapy, but there's not hardly anything in music therapy. There's like two other articles that were written in Nordic Journal, which are good, but it only focuses on improvisation, which is only one of our four methods. So how do we apply that to the different four methods of music therapy? And that's what the manuscript's about. But learning about that really kind of helped me. And then learning a little bit more about cognitive processing therapy. I got a lot of supervision from an art therapist who's also a psychologist, Dr. Marnie Rosen in Chicago. And she helped me learn a lot more about trauma. And there is just not enough that we have done in that area. We have a lot of, that's another podcast. We have a lot to go on that. I think we are very siloed. We got our heads down, looking at our fingers, playing guitar, that kind of thing. We're not looking up and looking at the band, you know. I think that's kind of like, there's so much going on and we are just not. Felicity Baker just wrote this great book on songwriting. That was really great to have because it is like magnum opus. This is what we do in songwriting and music therapy. Good. I don't have to do that. Thank God. But, you know, it's missing in it. It talks about cognitive therapy. It talks about psychodynamic therapies. It talks about outcome-based therapies. It does not specifically talk about trauma to like an in-depth way. And if you look at the way cognitive processing therapy is, it's written as, so this is creativity here. You notice that cognitive processing therapy looks at kind of this, you write an impact statement of why do you think this thing happened to you? And then you look for what they call stuck points, which are kind of this cognitive fallacies we're having, like everything I do is my fault. If I would have dressed differently, this wouldn't have happened. These are the things. Can you think of something in a song that is repetitive that we keep coming back to over and over again? It's called a chorus. So the stuck points are the choruses. The verses are the stories. The bridge is the alternate viewpoint, the challenges that we come when we're doing the cognitive processing thing. And then most pop songs end in a double chorus. So after you do the bridge, how are you going to change your chorus? And how is the music going to support, change, express all of these things and give an additional affective of component to it? So you aren't just writing about the trauma, you're also writing about your whole thought process and how it's changed. CPT is typically 12 sessions. It's like the first session you do this, second session you do this. We don't have ideas of dosage in music therapy. And we sit here and complain about like why we're not getting private insurance reimbursement. Show me the dosage for songwriting for trauma. If you can do that, there are, you know, assessments for trauma. It's called the PCL5. Have them do the PCL5 after 12 sessions, take them through the process of doing the songwriting project and see if the PCL5 changes. That's how you do that. And we aren't doing stuff like that in mental health and music therapy. We are not. And I might be getting a little too far off, but I think it's something we need to do, something I'm passionate about, something I will likely try to do.
Yeah. It's wonderful that you found your niche and found your passion. Do you feel like in trying to help inform people is one of your biggest challenges right now?
You know, it's interesting because it's like, I was thinking about that kind of today. I've written a few things where I've written one thing where I was like the most in control. I've written another thing where I had like a half and half sharing with somebody else and then helping with some other things where it's like, we need someone here to be a music therapist and to kind of help us with this larger thing. And it's like, I really didn't like that. You know, I think it's really hard to work with sometimes people. It's like they almost get it. And then I kind of realized when I was going back through and helping them, you know, rewrite an application for a fellowship, or, you know, helping people write an application for like a grant or something. You see how they write about stuff. And it's like, we're going to see how music therapy affects X medical thing. And then I go, no, you're not. You don't know how all of music therapy affects that thing. What this is songwriting. What this is improvisation. What this is playlist creation. What this is this. You're not saying, how does music therapy affect this? We should never be saying that. That's like, how does plumbing affect electricity? It's like, what are we talking about? It's how does this specific intervention thing, as applied by a board certified music therapist, make sure that's in there. So at first I was like, I don't really like working with these people because they don't really know what to talk about. Blah, 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 blah. But then I was like, oh, I get to go help write this. I get to help communicate this. I get to sit here and be like, oh, say it this way. And that way it makes it so much clearer to the people reading it. So I think at first, I think that part of me that is kind of hurt that I'm always like having to explain what music therapy is and doesn't like that. But there's this other part of me that's like, oh, I get to help in a way that's meaningful. It's not just that one person in the elevator. It's like, this is a grant, or this is like a real study here. And I want to make sure that it says what I would want it to say and communicates it effectively. And especially like when Houston Chronicle came in, I got to say like, hey, music therapy is a profession. That's really important to me. So I think I have mixed feelings about it, you know?
What is something you wish you'd known when you first started on your creative path?
I wish I had a more realistic outlook as to what music therapy pays and what the trajectory of the profession is. Because to tell you the truth, I don't think I would have gotten my master's in music therapy if I knew that, to be honest. Most people, you get a master's degree because our professional level degree, you can start working as a bachelor's degree, you get a master's degree, and the institutions will sometimes look at you and go, oh, good for you. You expanded your knowledge. They're like, so does that mean I get paycheck, please? They're like, no. Oh, okay. So you have to like plan your education and your training in the way that like is important for you and how you want to live your life. I kind of advise people sometimes for like, what do you want to get your master's in? Like, oh, music therapy. Why? Because I want to learn more about research. Does the place you work for have an IRB? Does the place that you work for, are they going to pay you more for getting a master's in music therapy? Without question. Because you're about to spend a lot of money. And I didn't have to spend the money on the college because of the GI Bill, the Hazelwood Act in Texas. But like, we're not giving people an accurate description of what that looks like. Because music therapists don't make much. And so what do we have to rely on? Our spouses? I'm not married. So it's just me. If it's just me, then I have to do something that's going to be better for me. You got to look at like, what does a counselor make in private practice? A music therapist is not licensed in Texas, so you could charge whatever you wanted, but we don't. And that's something else. Like, I wish more music therapists charged out the ass because we are so specialized. We come out of school with this kind of, aw shucks, it's just little old me kind of attitude. I think I'm only going to charge people $60. And it's like, no, you have such incredible skills. You need to charge 125. You need to charge 100. Because I'll tell you what, you know, when you're in a room with all these counselors and psychologists, it's like, you're not on the same level professionally as them. You're just not. So it's really important to know that like, you have to do what's right for you. And I think it's like, you have to do what's right for you from a financial standpoint. You have to live your life. You just took out a lot of loans. If you're going to get your master's, you might as well get your master's on that's going to get you paid more. That's really important. Get your doctorate in the thing that's going to be the PhD or the research thing, you know, because the people say like master's only music therapist. What do you pay? $45,000 for a master's level clinician? Like, no. So that's one thing I wish I knew a little bit. I probably would have gotten my master's in counseling right off the bat.
But devil's advocate here, you've gone on to do, you know, amazing things for the field.
Well, there's nothing. I'm not saying I didn't do anything good. I think I've done a lot of good things. I think I'm learning a lot by doing that. I'm not saying I'm not even thankful for my master's degree. I learned a lot, and I wouldn't have ended up at Houston Methodist. I'm never ungrateful for the experiences I've had. I'm only here because I did the Navy thing. I'm only here because I played like Uptown Funk 45,000 times and realized that like there's certain types of art where you're in the service industry. You know what I mean? Like you're not like in the creative industry, you're in the service industry. And I think there's probably an equivalent for that for like every single person who started out as artistic is like playing in the wedding band. If you love playing in the wedding band, play in the wedding band. You make a lot of money playing in the wedding band, but you're going to play Uptown Funk every night for the rest of your life. Is that what you want to do? It's not what you want to do. You should try something else. If you want to do the creative route, you're going to have another job. And you're not a failure at the creative route if you do that other job. I think that was the hard thing for me. Like I wanted to be in a band that was mine. And I still want that. And I'm really lucky that I get to do scratch one itch by helping people the way I want to help people. And then I also like, it's getting to that point where I'm like, oh, I think I could like start a band. That's cool. Do that. It's tough though. Cause like after jam sessions, people come up to you and they're like, hey, you want to join our band? I'm like, guys, like this is what you do. You're going to spend all weekend worrying about this, getting all your parts 100% right, going out there and doing the thing. I'm not your man for that. Like I used to do that. And it is a grind. It is such hard work. People have no idea how hard it is to be a musician. It is so hard. And again, it's another job where no one understands what you do. So it's just, you kind of have to own it and be like, oh, that's the job I chose. It's okay. And I really love my job.
Final two questions. One's just a fun one is, what is your favorite movie and what does it reveal about you?
Oh yeah, I saw that one. Damn it. I was like thinking about it so hard. Different times in my life, it was different ones. For a while, it was Heat. I love Michael Mann movies. He's awesome. Oh, I was always like a big Star Wars fan growing up. Oh man, that's such a hard thing. I grew up really loving how movies are made. And I love being amazed at that. Like, so I love going back and watching something like Back to the Future and be like, okay, how did they do that? They didn't have CGI, so how did they do that? So I love movies like that. I think that like 90s era of like Spielberg world, that's like my jam. I think that reveals to me that like, it reveals that I am like super interested in how things work and how they can make like kind of trick us and like, and help tell the story. So I love movies like that where I'm like, man, how did they do that? That's crazy. They didn't have computers. How did they do that? And if they can wow you and make you kind of forget you're watching the movie and like do that, I love stuff like that. That's why you go to the movies.
Yes, yes. Very true. Final question. In your own words, what does living a creative life mean to you?
I think that's what you should start with. Because that made me shut up and think, oh, God.
That's a good idea. I might have to do that.
And now I only have 2 minutes left to answer the big question.
We could jump back on a third time.
No, it's cool. So what does it mean to lead a creative life? Oh, man, it means that you can't help but like try to make connections in a brand new way. For instance, one time I had a wine bottle that I couldn't open because I didn't have a bottle opener. But I did have a power drill, a screw, and a hammer. So I screwed the screw into the cork and then used the hammer to go and pop it open. That's creativity, right? That's what it means to live a creative life. And you can't help but see things. And I think kind of the curse of that is you're always looking at stuff and being like, ah, you could do that better. Or you could do that differently. You know? So you're kind of, okay, what am I going to do here? How can we move with this? I think that's so helpful when you're a therapist, is people are different every single time. And you're like, oh God, okay, how am I going to work with this person? Oh, I got to be creative. Like it's great. You're always, it's so rewarding to be thinking that way and just like getting to think about like how I can solve an issue and also how can I be with somebody in that space. It's great. Love it.
Excellent. Well, those are some really great thoughts to end on. John, thank you so much for joining the podcast. Listeners, please check the show notes for John's bio and links to the American Music Therapy Association to learn more about our very interesting and creative field. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Like the show? Have a question? Stop by the Facebook and Instagram pages. Links are in the show notes, or search for Creative Piecemeal Podcast on social media and click follow for all the latest.